It's 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. In California's Mojave Desert, there's a fight over a huge solar power project. In Oklahoma, wind farms are developing rapidly, but so is opposition to them. In New Hampshire, a hydropower project known as Northern Pass has North Country residents up in arms. And in the Massachusetts Bay, the Cape Wind project is making plans to start construction after more than a decade of legal battles. It seems as if many an alternative energy project that pops up from coast to coast is met with some sort of not-in-my-backyard or NIMBY resistance. People don't want their cherished home views disturbed by new wind turbines or giant solar panels. They worry about the health effects of new transmission lines that will have to be built to accommodate new sources of power, or they're concerned that these lines will bring down property values. And in some of these cases, the desire for clean energy clashes with the desire to protect endangered species whose habitat might be harmed. But some analysts say while these concerns are human nature and are understandable, they also worry that this trend will mean we're married to fossil fuels forever unless we can find a better way to balance between national clean energy goals and local opposition to specific projects on the ground. Today in The Exchange, NIMBY goes green, why it's been so hard to find that balance, and new ideas to achieve it. Let's hear from you, too. Have you seen renewable energy projects blocked by local opposition? Do you think that factors like property values or animal habitat should trump these kind of projects? Or should the national goal of more renewable energy outweigh local concerns? Give us your thoughts. Call in 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR, or send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. We have three guests with us in studio. Christoph Korshain, staff attorney for the Conservation Law Foundation in New Hampshire. And Christoph, nice to meet you. Thanks for being here.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Also with us, Donald Kreese. He's an assistant professor of law and associate director of the Institute for Energy and the Environment at the Vermont Law School. He's also the former general counsel for the New Hampshire Public Utilities Commission. And Donald Kreese, welcome back to The Exchange. Good to have you.
It's a great pleasure to be here.
Also with us, Larry Susskind, professor of urban and environmental planning at MIT, vice chair of the program on negotiation at Harvard Law School. He also founded a nonprofit called the Consensus Building Institute, which helps mediate complex public disputes like wind power or solar power siting. And Larry, really nice to have you. Thank you also for your time.
You're welcome.
Well, and Larry, let's start with you. This isn't just happening in the United States or here in New England. The Paris-based International Energy Agency calls the new NIMBY one of the top threats to the growth of renewable energy worldwide. What do you think's going on, Larry? You first.
Well, I don't think NIMBY is really the right way to think about it. Anytime we build anything, there are a few people who are going to gain a lot directly and a few people who are right next to it or whose view is going to be impeded, who are very much opposed, and the vast majority of people waiting to see what's this proposal, what are the gains, what are the losses, long-term, short-term. And I would expect anyone proposing to build a facility, renewable energy or otherwise, to take all those people, that vast majority of people in the middle, seriously. And too often, the way in which we go about these projects, people act as if decisions have been made, we're just announcing it. And then that gets all those people in the middle upset. I think if we ran these processes differently, we wouldn't be getting the same kind of opposition.
So, Larry, it's not NIMBY. It's just bad planning, poor planning?
It's bad process. You have to give people a heads up that something's going to happen. You have to give them information. You have to give them a chance to participate in the conversation. And if they feel the process has already been decided or nobody's really listening to them or they're not going to be compensated for real losses, then they all swing with the very small number of people who actually stand to lose a lot. We can't make decisions that give everybody everything they want, but unless we make decisions that give everybody a chance to participate and give most people a way to see that this is advantageous, then we'll have this opposition. It's true of fossil fuels. It's true of renewable energy.
Well, and Don Kreese, you've been working in this area for a long time. You do see a lot of headlines in recent years on the contradiction between supporting alternative energy in a global sense but not supporting it locally when it's in your own backyard. What do you think?
Well, I agree with Professor Susskind that the word NIMBY really is a pejorative term that doesn't help anybody. Ultimately, though, there is a almost an irreconcilable difference between the greater good, meaning everybody in New England benefiting from a project like the Northern Pass, and the interests of the people who are going to see a new transmission line literally going right through their backyard.
So irreconcilable, though. Why do you use that term, Don?
Well, because there are always going to be, as Professor Susskind just said, people who suffer a disproportionate direct impact, whereas me sitting in my office in Vermont, the benefit that I'm going to derive from that Northern Pass is very remote, but also very small.
Well, what do you think, Christoph? You know, does this mean we're going to be married to fossil fuels forever because we just can't get over these new projects in our own backyards?
I think Professor Susskind gives us a roadmap for how we can get to some of these projects. I think it's very important to consider each project on its own merits. Just because a project's been proposed and it's been called, quote, renewable energy, doesn't mean it's going to have substantial public benefits. It doesn't mean that the folks who are against it for environmental reasons are doing so as a pretext and they don't want it in their backyard. There's definitely a need to look at the particular people who are going to benefit from a particular project economically, look at that critically, and then look at how that project fits in to the greater public policy goals which we're talking about. Lower carbon emissions, climate change issues, and the energy future of the region in terms of energy dependence, weaning us off of fossil fuels, and developing, you know, local renewable energy, which I think every state in New England supports wholeheartedly as a matter of public policy.
Wholeheartedly so, until it comes in their own backyard.
Well, I think if you look at each project does create a bunch of camps. And I think it's more than two generally. In certain cases, to take the kind of one of the examples you mentioned at the beginning of the show, Cape Wind, I think that the environmental community overall came to support that project, despite the concerns about avian impacts, despite the concerns about constructing wind turbines on the seafloor. That kind of position developed over time as the project was reviewed, as the project sponsor made certain commitments to do environmental mitigation, and it became clear that there were real energy benefits associated with getting utility scale wind into the New England market in a reasonable location.
Our phone number on the exchange is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Today in the exchange, we're talking about finding that tricky balance between supporting renewable energies like wind or solar or biomass or hydro, finding the balance between supporting those and the impact on our local communities when sometimes it may hurt our property values or ruin our views or hurt an endangered species. Let's hear from you. 1-800-892-6477. Have you seen renewable energy projects blocked by local opposition? How do you think things like property values or animal habitat trump these kind of projects? Or should the national goals of more renewable energy outweigh local concerns? We'd love your thoughts. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Email us, exchange@nhpr.org. And Larry Susskind, I want to follow up with you on something that Christoph said. He used an important word, public benefit. In some of these cases across the country, opponents fear that industry is just slapping a green label across projects that communities are very upset about for a variety of reasons. They say follow the money. These projects aren't really green. That, you know, the energy industry is doing what it always did, just trying to find a way to build more. What do you think? Is that fair?
I don't think that's reasonable at all. We have a procedure in the United States and in other parts of the world for making decisions that are meant to define what's in the public interest. We say something is set in policy. So we have states that say we want to encourage renewable energy. So we have policies set by our elected officials. Then we have to make case-specific decisions. What would be a good decision? Well, clearly, one in which the gains to all the gainers outweigh the losses to some losers. And you've taxed some of those gains, you've garnered some of that money from those who make a profit, and you use it to compensate the losers, but still the gains to the gainers outweigh the losses to the losers. We tend to say, as long as that happens within a democratic context, that that's a good decision. There was a wind developer on the Cape a couple weeks ago who stood up and said, I hear you are concerned about property values. I'm going to buy you property value insurance. I am so convinced that these four turbines won't affect your property values that I will guarantee you that as of today, your appraised value, the assessed value of your house won't go down after these turbines are built any more than in general properties in the area went down. And if you want to sell your house at any point and you don't get that fair value, you'll be compensated from an insurance fund. So now you don't need to worry about property values anymore. Those are the kinds of ways that we make decisions. Everybody doesn't get everything that they want, but in a public benefits context, all the gains to all the many people, even thousands of people who gain a little bit, you add that up, that's a big number. If there's a small number of people who stand to lose something, we should compensate them. I don't think that's a problem. And if there's not enough money there from the benefits to compensate them, then that particular technology at that site at that time is a bad decision. Let's go on to another one.
Does that compensation, though, Larry, make these kinds of projects too expensive to pursue? If you could be real quick there.
If they're too expensive, then let's wait till we have a different technology, or let's wait till some place is eager enough to have them, and it bids and says, come here, build that here.
All right.
We want the property taxes.
We'll go to a very short break, and when we come back, more questions and your phone calls at 1-800-892-6477. Stay with us.
Good morning, it's 9:19, and you're listening to The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio. Support for NHPR comes from you, our members, and from the Mount Washington Auto Road, celebrating 150 years of tours filled with weather and history to the summit of Mount Washington, mt-washington.com. And from Northeast Delta Dental, administering dental benefits for businesses of all sizes in New Hampshire, Maine, and Vermont. Details online at nedelta.com. On the forecast today, it'll be cloudy towards the south and seacoast, increasing sunshine towards the north country, though. This afternoon and evening, showers and thunderstorms statewide. It won't be too hot, but muggy. Highs in the upper 70s north, lower 80s south. Remaining overcast tonight, areas of fog still humid, lows in the lower to mid-50s in the north and west, up to the mid-60s on the coast. This is The Exchange from New Hampshire Public Radio. It's 9:20.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, green energy sounds good until perhaps it comes too close to home or infringes on other environmental concerns like wildlife habitat. We're talking about this today in The Exchange, and we'd love to hear from you. How do you think items, factors like property values, animal habitat, health concerns, trump these kinds of renewable energy projects? Or should the national goal of more renewable energy outweigh, at times, local concerns? 1-800-892-6477. The email is exchange@nhpr.org. And before we go to the phones, gentlemen, I did want to ask you, I think, Don Kreese, what kinds of projects seem to generate the most opposition? Is it biomass? Is it wind? Is it solar? Where do people seem to get the most upset?
Here in Vermont, I would say it tends to be wind projects in particular. And I would introduce into the discussion the notion of environmental justice. Historically, fossil-fueled power plants tend to be built in urban areas where people aren't especially empowered or wealthy, whereas here in Vermont, you have folks who moved up from Connecticut, either part-time or full-time, or New York, and they bought their 50 acres of land on a verdant hillside, and They have a house that looks like it was built in 1840, and lo and behold, a developer comes along and wants to put in a utility-scale wind plant with 400-foot-tall turbines, and those folks don't like it, and they tend to be very empowered and very active. And as a result, wind power development has faced a tough road here in Vermont.
Yeah, so the folks who move up say, hey, I moved up because it's pretty. I want it to stay pretty, so no thank you.
Indeed.
Did you want to add anything on there, Don?
Well, I want to say that in light of climate change, our view here at Vermont Law School is that we have to throw everything we have at this problem. I think you also have to draw a distinction between the actual energy generation facilities and the transmission lines, because they raise somewhat different issues. Obviously, if I put up an array of wind turbines, that's renewable energy. I don't think anybody suggests that wind isn't a renewable form of energy. But if I build a transmission line across central New England or across New Hampshire, there's always the concern that it isn't just going to move energy around that's renewable. It's going to move all sorts of energy around. And so it's less persuasive as a renewable energy project.
Well, yeah, why is that? Don, to you first, but others as well. Why is it so often that it's not the actual power source that causes concerns, but the transmission lines to bring that energy where it needs to go? How come, Don? Why aren't the old lines good enough?
Well, historically, we haven't invested enough in transmission infrastructure. It's harder to build. It's very expensive. Historically, it was easier to site non-renewable generation facilities right next to the load. If I, think of the power plant down in Bow near Concord. That's actually quite close to where all the people in New Hampshire are. You don't have to build big, huge transmission lines. If you want to put a big biomass boiler up in Berlin and generate 70 megawatts of power, you have to find a way to ship that power to the place where all the people are who need the power.
Yeah, Christoph, your thoughts, please.
It's definitely the case that transmission has been underemphasized, and we need a sustainable plan to bring renewable energy from the locations where it can be generated as a technical matter to population centers. And we need to do that in an open public process that looks at the regionally what are the best places to build those transmission lines. Then the second phase of that conversation, when you're talking about transmission, is are there non-transmission alternatives to supplying the same amount of power? And that sometimes gets lost when we start talking about a particular project. But are there energy efficiency programs? Are there conservation measures which would be cheaper than building new transmission lines or siting new facilities that would generate the same amount of power? Those types of issues have not been, in CLF's view, appropriately and consistently analyzed. And if they were, our view is that there would be substantial additional investments in energy efficiency, which is avoiding generation of power, and there would be potentials to mitigate the amount of transmission infrastructure that needs to be constructed and the facilities that need to be constructed.
What do some people call, Christoph, conservation? The biggest alternative energy is actually conserving what we already have.
And
I've heard folks say
absolutely.
That. All right, let's take some calls, gentlemen. Again, our number 1-800-892-6477. And up first from Dalton is Jim. Hi, Jim, you're on The Exchange. Go ahead.
Hi, thank you for taking my call, Laura. I think the professor has identified the right balancing here, which is public benefits versus private costs. My question is whether one could put a finer measure on private costs. We often look at eminent domain, and I think there is a stack of studies you could raise as high as a tower that says eminent domain compensation almost never fully compensates the landowner. To use a very simple example, Laura, if you own your home, you own your home because you love it and you want to keep it. You don't look to sell it every day for its market value.
Right.
My question is this. Is there a way to incorporate into the private benefits, public costs, public benefit, private cost calculus, a more accurate assessment of the private costs, i.e. a subjective value, that landowners attach to their land?
Yeah, Jim, thanks. Good point. And I think that was you, Larry Susskind. What do you think? Eminent domain and compensating people whose property values are harmed.
Well, let's take the transmission line question and take the caller's concerns in that area. I believe that the shortest distance between two points for transmission purposes is not a straight line. Because when you lay out a transmission line and you say, got to go from here to there, then you cross all kinds of properties where those subjective concerns of some people are really high, even if the market value of their property isn't so high. And if what you said is, we got to get from here to there, who would like us to pay them to put this line over their land? Because they want the compensation that comes from giving us the rights to put the power line there. You would get a zigzag line, but every place you put it, or most places you put it, people would want it there. At that point, if you still had a few missing links, at that point you would go to those folks and say, we do have to take this property, be a much smaller percentage, and those people would understand that that's the product of everybody else attaching what real value they have to their property and making these bids. And my notion is we need a different kind of forum to have the discussions. Which part of power line should be underground? I know it's more expensive. Which part should be above ground? Which way shall we move this from here to there? Did we make a big enough effort to conserve energy before we proposed to build again? We need a forum, not the legislative forum, but a public policy discussion forum, in which a lot of people can participate before these decisions are made. The final choices will be much more legitimate if they are the product of a serious conversation.
Yet it takes a lot longer, right, Larry? I mean, a lot longer.
But in this way, it takes a short time, and then it takes a long time to go to court. I'd rather have the total amount of time be less by going more slowly at the beginning to really involve people in the conversation.
You know, just to ask a specific question to you, Don Kreese, given that you used to be at the New Hampshire Public Utilities Commission, in the Northern Pass project, what Larry just said about should parts of a certain project have the lines put underground, that has been proposed by some environmental groups in the Northern Pass project, but the company says, look, A, this is way, way, way more expensive, and B, that entails a certain amount of environmental disruption as well. You're digging up land, you're uprooting trees, and so forth. What are your thoughts on that, again, as someone who, you know, really looked at this at the PUC?
I think underground transmission lines in rural areas are, for the most part, not feasible. It's vastly more expensive to build that way, and it's hard to maintain transmission lines. The Northern Pass project is interesting because of the way it's funded. It's essentially being paid for by out of the power deal that Hydro-Quebec has cut with the utilities in central New England. So it isn't electric ratepayers in New Hampshire who are going to pay for that. And so when you take measures to mitigate the impacts of that transmission line across northern New Hampshire, it's basically people far away who are going to pay any additional costs, and the utilities have to pay for that themselves and then hopefully recover it from their customers. So it's a tricky proposition.
Well, Jim and Dalton, again, thanks for that call. Our number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. How do you think we can reach a better balance between personal or local concerns about new energy projects and supporting the broader goal of renewable energy? Our number, 1-800-892-6477, the email exchange at nhpr.org. You know, Christoph, I wanted to ask you again, you're with the Conservation Law Foundation. How do we weigh the greenness of these projects anyway? I mean, hydropower has a bad rap because it disrupts natural water flow. Biomass has a bad rap because some say it creates some measure of air pollution. Wind, some people don't like the noise from the turbines and they worry about avian impacts or that it hurts the birds. Solar power on a grand scale, as we've seen in California, requires huge, you know, fields of solar panels, which has disrupted some endangered species there. So, you know, how do we pick and choose? Sometimes you look at the concerns and you go, maybe we should just stick with fossil fuels. What do you think?
Well, I think that there's a situation where there's a false choice in your question, I think. There's for projects that have kind of clear renewable energy benefits that meet all the criteria for renewable energy that are built into public policy. And you mentioned that there's a line there between there's green sources and there's deep green sources. We've gone through a number of years of CLF has of advocacy on these issues, and the legislatures have worked through these issues, and there's been decisions made about what forms of renewable energy should we subsidize through the renewable portfolio standards, for example. There have been decisions made about which direction do we want our energy system to go in, and generally that's a lower carbon energy future for the region and for the country, because you're right about the context. The context is a planetary emergency on climate issues. We have a warming climate, and nationally we are not doing what needs to be done to bring the country into a position where we're lowering our carbon emissions year after year and getting to the goals which the scientific community says we need to get to slow and eventually halt the warming trend. So you're right about the context. And once you establish that context, there are still important decisions that need to be made with respect to each project, with respect to each technology. You want to favor the efficient technologies. You want to favor technologies that do not are very cost effective. But on the other hand, you want technologies that are environmentally as less impacting as possible, and to have the support of local communities. I think that's a key thing that has not happened when you talk about the Northern Pass project. There has not been the kind of regional conversation, public conversation with the people who will be affected by this project in advance of it being proposed. And that has really been a fatal flaw so far, and has encouraged a lot of people to speak out against it. Those types of things are really prerequisites for successful projects that can garner public support and the support of the environmental community, and will go through the permitting process in a reasonable time frame.
It's tricky, though, isn't it, Christoph? And Larry, I'd like to hear from you, too, on this. I mean, Christoph hit it on the head. There's green and then there's deep green. I mean, how do you, in your conversations about which projects deserve to go ahead and which ones perhaps do not, how do you make those assessments?
Well, from my standpoint, it's always as compared to what? You several times have posed the question, renewable energy as compared to fossil fuel. Well, fossil fuel, we have lived with the costs and the impacts. And people forget, right? They forget that there was a problem in the Gulf, right? We have a whole set of costs, environmental, social, security-related costs associated with fossil fuel. If someone says, I don't want to see those windmills off 6 miles off the shore, we say, well, as compared to what? And they say, well, I want my energy, and so build fossil fuel plants somewhere up in the Boston area and send it down to me here, and I'll pay whatever it costs. But the people who live up where the fossil fuel plants are built have a series of health impacts and environmental impacts that I would argue are much more severe than what someone's concerned about looking at windmills along the horizon 6 miles away. And so it's not, can you build something that has no effects? Because that's not possible. But if you say, can we build renewable energy with lower social, economic, and environmental effects over time than fossil fuel? I don't think there's any doubt about it.
So
we have to put things in the right context when we're making decisions. And that's what the public policy choices, where you set the framework, is supposed to do. Then you need specific projects, as Christoph said, to have local conversations and local support. And there needs to be at the local level a way for all the people who stand to lose to be compensated enough so that all the people who stand to gain are willing to be taxed part of that gain to compensate the losers. And if it's not going to come out that way, then that's the wrong project to do. But you can't say, I don't want any effect.
Because we need to think about, as compared to what, then. I wonder how often people do that, though, Larry.
not often enough. When you think about the security effects of having to import oil and gas, if you think about the social impacts of people living where mining, mountaintop mining is going on, those have to be calculated in and compared to producing a unit of energy from a wind turbine or from a photovoltaic system. And I think those questions are not pressed hard enough. And the kind of public meetings that I've listened to where people stand up and say, it's going to ruin our view of the ridge. And how are we going to get the power to all the people who need it for all the purposes they need it? That question doesn't get asked in those conversations. We need to restructure those conversations to make them less of the soap opera, stand up and yell and scream about what only you want, and a more reasoned conversation about what's best for everybody.
Let's take another call, gentlemen. This is Sarah in Wolfboro. Hi, Sarah, you're on The Exchange. Go ahead.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just want to first say I very much agree with the last comment that was made about having to compare the impacts of different energy sources. But I also wanted to say that I don't think the public has a good understanding of the scale at which we're going to have to build alternative energy sources in order to replace fossil fuels. In the United States, we're going to have to build 4 million wind turbines and 160 billion square meters of solar panels to replace fossil fuels. At a global level, we're talking about, you know, massive structures here. And to me, that means everyone's going to be seeing these things in their backyard at some point. And, you know, that's just the price we're going to pay. So I think if people understood the scale at which this has to happen, then we might have a better sense that we're all in this together. We all have to make sacrifices. But the kind of sacrifices we're making, as was noted, are much less than the people in Appalachia who have to deal with, you know, whole mountains being removed and their water supplies being contaminated by mountaintop removal mining.
So some folks have already paid the price. And Sarah, you're saying in the future we're all going to have to put up with a little bit of this. So I want to get our guests' comments after a short break. Sarah, thanks for that call. We'll keep taking your calls, too, at 1-800-892-6477 or email us exchange@nhpr.org. And we'll be right back.
You might not know, but maintaining NHPR's 8 transmitters around the state is a labor-intensive undertaking.
There's not a whole lot of infrastructure at some of these sites.
That's Mike Saffel, our director of technology, and he's being diplomatic. Some of our transmitter sites are downright remote.
It'll take you 3 and some hours to get to Colebrook. Once you get to the bottom of the hill, then it's another hour to get everything together to get up the hill because of the conditions.
NHPR goes the extra mile to bring you great programs. Now you know.
It's 9:39. Good morning. Support for New Hampshire Public Radio comes from you, our members, and from Grapponi Auto Group, featuring multiple lines of fuel-efficient, environmentally friendly cars at Grapponi Auto Junction in Bow and online 24 hours a day at grapponi.com. And from Monadnock Music, presenting Chamber Masterpieces 4, works by J.S. Bach, Thomas Addis, and Schubert, Sunday at the Peterborough Townhouse, monadnockmusic.org. This is New Hampshire Public Radio.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today we're talking about renewable energy and how to balance the desire for more clean, green energy along with other priorities such as local property values, wildlife habitat, quality of the local landscape. Give us a call. Give us your thoughts at 1-800-892-6477 or email us exchange@nhpr.org. And Don Kreese with the Vermont Law School. I did want to throw to you Sarah's question. She said right now people don't realize the massive scale upon which we're going to have to build hydro or solar or wind. And when people realize that, they realize that it's going to be in everybody's backyard. What do you think about that, Don?
I agree with that. I would, however, like to introduce what might be a controversial proposition into the discussion. I actually think that wind turbines are quite beautiful, and I would be happy to live within sight of one. You can drive Route 8 here in Vermont, south right into Massachusetts at our southern border, and you can drive quite close to the wind turbines that have been built in Searsburg, and I think they're a very visually fascinating phenomenon. I think about lighthouses a lot. Imagine back in the 18th century, if we had the kind of public processes we had now, imagine what people would say if I said, well, I'm going to build this 10-story structure right on the seacoast, you know, marring your beautiful view, and it's going to be there forever, and you're going to have to deal with it. People would, I think, be up in arms. But today we think of lighthouses as these beautiful, picturesque, and iconic objects. We put them on postage stamps and postcards. So I think there is some, in fact, I think it's inevitable that someday wind turbines will be regarded with the same sense of reverence.
Well, and another question towards Sarah's question on scale. Christoph, this is for you. There's another idea here that some people have talked about, and that is you don't have to build huge renewable energy projects. You could have a wind turbine on top of your house, a small one. I could have a solar panel on top of my house, a small one. So it doesn't need to be sort of grid scale, feeding to the broader grid. If it's more individual, you don't have these big giant impacts that folks get upset about.
We definitely, CLF definitely thinks there has to be a role for those types of projects. The challenge right now is that economically it's very difficult for a homeowner to make that economic decision, and sometimes the payback period is a long period. That's why the idea of having rebates and subsidies for those particular small-scale homeowner projects are so important, and we think that there hasn't been enough imagination deployed on how to get those projects, how to get those pieces of energy infrastructure throughout New England put up on people's homes. But that will play a smaller role. We are in an area where the sun doesn't shine all the time. You may put up a wind turbine and it may not generate as much power as was hoped. It varies depending on the weather. So there are intermittency challenges, so you do need utility scale projects, and there will be a need for those in the foreseeable future. But unless we're doing all of the things that, you know, we're it's a full court press. Unless we're having this type of full court press with every possible idea, we're not going to meet these ambitious goals that we think are necessary.
Well, utility scale, then yes, but you're also saying yes, homeowner scale, individual business scale, but very expensive, as you said, for the individual to put the solar panel on top of the house. You call for more subsidies, but then, you know, that gets into how do we spend our public tax dollars? I mean, why should my tax dollars subsidize your nice solar panel?
Well, I think there should be an economic calculation. If it makes sense and reduces demand by a substantial amount, I think there is a public benefit with that. It's as Professor Susskind said, there's substantial costs associated with just generating the power that are not incorporated into electric rates, that are environmental costs, and the environmental justice implications as well of having plants in urban areas where there are tremendous asthma problems and there are tremendous particulate matter emissions from some of these fossil fuel plants. And so, you know, some of those costs are not internal to the prices we pay for energy. It's certainly not the case in terms of gas prices, despite how high they are.
Well, here's an email from Marjorie in Hanover on that point. She says, New England residents rely 40% to 50% of their electricity being generated by coal plants in other states. I'm sure that many residents living in the areas where coal is excavated and burned would rather not have those facilities in their backyard but have no choice. The mountains of West Virginia would be much more beautiful without mountaintop removal and living near a coal-burning plant. I think, Marjorie says, we should all share in the economic as well as aesthetic costs of creating sources of renewable energy. I would rather view poles carrying renewable energy and wind turbines than look at oil rigs or a coal-burning plant. What do you think about that, Larry Susskind? It kind of goes along with what you said earlier.
I think that's a brilliant comment because it puts things in the kind of context that everybody ought to be thinking in, which is it's not just about me. And we have a national need. First, let's have the most efficient systems we can. Let's reduce when we can. Let's have greater efficiency, reduce the total demand. After that, we're going to have a variety of things. We're going to rely in part on natural gas. We're going to rely in part on nuclear for as long as those facilities that we've already invested in can continue to operate safely. We're going to rely on renewables. The numbers that I think Sarah gave were the numbers that if you just switched everything to renewables. We're not going to do that. But let's look at the overall mix. Let's look at the sunk investment we have in things. And as coal-fired power plants reach their mandatory retirement age, let's not build them again, because the overall cost and benefits, when you take everything into account, are not worth it. So let's look at substituting renewables as we go for all the coal-fired power plants that have the biggest effect overall relative to climate change and health benefits. It would happen gradually. We're going to be moving in this direction, but that means we've got to get everybody to think in terms of national energy policy, not just their own house or their own neighborhood.
Well, and here's another comment we got on our Facebook site, and I'll throw this one to you, Don Kreese. This is from Bill. He says, sometimes through discourse, it becomes apparent that NIMBY is covertly banana. Build absolutely nothing anywhere near anything. What do you think, Donald?
I think that's a perceptive comment. I was thinking about something Christoph said earlier about the need to have public participation in these projects as they're conceived. The problem is that that's unrealistic in a system where we rely on investor-owned businesses to create this infrastructure for us. The fact is that if you're Northeast Utilities or NSTAR and you're looking at cutting a deal with the folks up in Hydro-Quebec, up in Canada, and it requires you to build a transmission line, there's no place in those private business negotiations for the landowners who are going to be, affected by this along the way. As the other guests have been saying, we have to throw everything we have at this problem, and it is going to require all sorts of technologies. It's going to require new transmission. It's going to require renewables. It's going to require moving power around, and it's going to require us to try to operate our fossil fuels responsibly.
Let's take another call, gentlemen. This is Bonnie in Nottingham. Hi, Bonnie. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hey, good morning.
Morning.
I was just wanting to jump back to this statement made earlier that the Northern Pass tower lines would be paid for by people out of state. And I think that's a very inaccurate statement and almost a dangerous one for us in New Hampshire, where we do rely on the property tax for our education budgets, for our municipal budgets, and for our county budgets. And as a 25-year former real estate broker who owned her own agency here in New Hampshire, I'm very much concerned that this project would cause plummeting property values all along it, as well as plummeting property values of any property that has a view of it, and that then, therefore, every other property in that town, and there are 44 towns, there are 44 towns in this project that it will be marching through. Every other property value will then be afflicted with a much higher tax rate to make up the difference for the lost values. I think we're going to see aggregate assessments in communities really plummet. And that is costing everyone in those communities.
Bonnie, can I ask you a quick question? I'm glad you called.
Yeah.
So Larry Susskind talked earlier about, you know, companies promoting these projects need to fairly compensate people for lost property values. But you're saying, look, that's never going to be enough.
It would have to be recurring revenue every year, because this is not a one-time thing that they can buy your property rights. They can buy the rights over your property, and it's not going to infect your community forever. It's like going back to the old Lakota notion that what we do affects everybody. The environment has no state boundaries or national boundaries. If you burn coal in the Midwest, that acid rain's going to come over New England. We've got to stop being myopic about how we view these mega projects that the citizenry is going to have to pay for forever.
So, Bonnie, a question for you, and I'm glad you called. So you mentioned, you know, the acid rain from coal, and sure, there are impacts from fossil fuels. We all know about it. So I just wonder, how do we find that balance between your legitimate concern about property values, but also the legitimate concern about, you know, air pollution and climate change and all that bad stuff that evolves from fossil fuels? What do you think?
Well, I know that it's a very large and complicated question, problem. It's not one that's my particular area of expertise, but property values is my
area. Sure. I just wonder what you think.
I think that we need to put a giant national effort and a giant statewide effort in every state into developing alternative methods. And not sustainability and lack of carbon are just two issues. Sustainability, which is supposedly water, hydro is no good if it's not green.
Okay. Bonnie,
you know, that company has made a mess of something like Seven Rivers up in Quebec. They've been refused passage through the provinces on either side of them. You know, supposedly they're not going to Vermont because Vermont has much stricter environmental laws than New Hampshire.
So and in the interest of time, I'm so sorry, but we just have a couple minutes left, and I'm really glad that she called. This gets back to what we talked about a little bit earlier, Christoph. You know, there's no such thing as a perfect shade of green.
That's true. Bonnie makes good points. And there's when you have a project like the Northern Pass Project, which has really brought a range of local, state, regional, national issues into one conversation, it becomes very difficult, and it is a difficult conversation. However, what CLF is advocating in this particular process, which isn't over yet, which is at the beginning stages of the project, is for this public conversation to include the property tax issue, to have a legitimate peer-reviewed analysis of the economic impact and the costs and benefits associated with those types of impacts. And that type of analysis we think needs to be done on a regional basis before we can consider this project in isolation. So there's a need to widen the analysis beyond this particular project. And to speak to something that Don Kreese mentioned a little while ago, that it's true that it's very difficult for business organizations to incorporate kind of a public process into their internal corporate decision making. There needs to be innovative solutions for that to happen, because you're going to have situations like this where there is an outcry about a pre-baked project that is not responsive to public concerns.
Oh, I hear what you're saying, and Bonnie, what she's saying, and Larry Susskind has said this too. You know, Christoph, widen the analysis, but do you widen it to the point where you're considering so many factors that all of these projects get blocked, that they never go anywhere, that it just becomes too long and too expensive?
Well, it's that's really an argument against careful planning, and one of the important things about this project is it requires public approvals, including the Department of Energy to say in its final presidential permit for this project across the border that the project is in the public interest. And if it's going to reach that type of determination, it's got to consider the broad array of factors. It's got to consider the economic, the environmental, from all angles.
The economic ones that our caller talked about.
Yes.
You know, Larry Susskind, I know this is right up your alley. What do you think? At what point do you consider so many points of view that the project is doomed?
Well, first, three quick points in response to that. In terms of how much time things take, if you say we have 6 months to make this decision, we want to involve everybody, then that's how much time it takes. If you say we have 3 months, these processes aren't open-ended. And if you know how much time you have, there are different ways of engaging broad communities in conversation. So I don't think that how much time it's going to take for the extra analysis is an issue. The second point is there's no way we're going to get these analyses exactly right. We're talking about very complicated problems. So what we need to do, and go back to the power line question and the property values point that was raised, we need to make contingent commitments. You want to build this? Fine. You say it's not going to affect property values? Fine. We're going to analyze the effect the first 6 months and 1 year in terms of home sales after that. And if the houses near the line lose value, you're going to have to compensate people. If you're so sure it's not going to have an effect, then no problem. You shouldn't disagree.
Okay.
If you think it might have an effect, you'll have to set aside some funds to compensate people to do that. We need contingent commitments because we can't get everything right up front.
And Larry, I have to cut you off there. I apologize. And I just want to close, gentlemen, with an email from Lori who says, I wonder if I'm the only person on the planet who wonders what our ancestors thought about all those telephone poles being a blight on the land. Perhaps they cheered at the arrival of electricity. Perhaps our leaders have failed to make the case for alternative energy. Thanks for that email, Lori. And Larry Susskind, I really want to thank you for being here. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
That's Professor Larry Susskind. He's at MIT and Harvard Law School. Donald Kreese, good to have you again. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
And that's Don Kreese. He's at the Vermont School of Law. And Christoph Korshain, good to have you in studio. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And Christoph Korshain is with the Conservation Law Foundation in New Hampshire. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. Our producer is Ellen Grimm. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our intern is Carrie Feltner. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. Our engineer today is Taylor Quimby. Our executive producer is Keith Shields. And I'm Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
I'm Laura Kanoy, and tomorrow on The Exchange, teen alcohol abuse in Vermont and New Hampshire. A new federal study finds these neighboring states have among the country's highest rates of youth drinking, with Vermont first and New Hampshire third. We'll talk about this dubious distinction with those involved in this issue on both sides of the Connecticut River about what might be done to address this problem. Email us at nhpr.org and join us for The Exchange tomorrow morning live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. here on NHPR.
Diane Rehm Show is next here on New Hampshire Public Radio at 10 o'clock. Support for NHPR comes from you, our members, and from the 54th Annual New Hampshire Antiques Show at the Radisson Hotel in Manchester, August 11th, 12th, and 13th.